And now for something different on the Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs Fiction Podcast, a segment I'm calling Between the Covers, where I interview my guest author this week, Jody J. Sperling, and you can get to know a little bit more about him and his story. In the Garden of End Times by Jody J. Sperling. Jesus finished the beetle picking early and went to a village in rural Kent for a beer. What she really looked forward to was the day of restoration, when she could drink wine again. But 2,000 years ago, incarnate in the masculine, Jesus had been the sort to dole out hasty vows, which is why he said, "For I say unto you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God shall come." And promises are promises. The normal retinue of tag-alongs were in attendance, and sitting on a high stool, Jesus was trying to ignore a rabbi's doctrinal barrage of questions on account of the television, tuned to ESPN. The ticker at the bottom of the screen showed the Chicago Cubs had lost again. Anywhere her father plants his gardens, from the South Bronx to Macassar, Jesus hunts for Cub scores, because this is all her father has told her regarding his timeline for the restoration. "You will know the time is near when the Cubs win the World Series 3 times. And that is the beginning of Jody J. Sperling's story, In the Garden of End Times, on the Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs Fiction Podcast. Jody, thank you for lending me that story to produce on the show.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. I'm really excited. I love your narrating, and so a story that I'm proud of will be even better with your narration.
I appreciate that. So, the obvious question here is, where did this story come from? Why did you write a story about Jesus coming back as a woman, waiting for the Cubs to win the World Series?
Yeah. So when I was in school in Spokane, Washington, I met one of my classmates, JP, and he and I had similar upbringings in some way. We both grew up in the church, and both of us had come to a place in our lives where we probably had as many questions about the faith that we were raised in as we did maybe feelings of like comfort and belonging. And so at that point, my family was still going to church, but really it was almost like recreational. My wife and I would sit in the congregation, and the pastor we had at the time, he did this thing where he would say, "Right?" And he would tilt his head up. And then I can't remember the other word he said, but he would tilt his head down. He had these very specific actions while he was preaching. And my wife and I would make bets on how many times he would say, "Right," and tilt his head up. It was like entertainment for us as much as anything. But so my friend JP and I are talking about the different kinds of things that we want to challenge each other to write. And this came out of a challenge to write something that would really upset people within the church and yet reflect something we believed might possibly be true. And so I thought, what a better way than to have Jesus be a lady who appears in a cornfield and is, I think, pretty sassy. And so I really enjoyed it, and I'm happy with the end product, and that's where it came from.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as someone who did not grow up in the church, it wasn't offensive to me in that way. But I found it interesting that the Jesus in your story is a little bit of a misogynist in her opinion about men and women.
Yeah.
"Hey, pal," the woman said to the rabbi. "Leave the lady alone." "I said I didn't need any help," Jesus said. She fixed her gaze on the row of liquor bottles beneath the mirror that ran the length of the bar. "I'm man enough to handle my own problems." "What did you say?" "I'm man enough to handle my own problems." The woman looked Jesus up and down, lingering on her bust, and laughed. Wonders never cease.
She straightened the heavy framed glasses on her face and said, There's nothing wrong with being a strong woman. Jesus said,
There are no strong women, only women and men. Jesus effing Christ. That's me, the Alpha and the Omega. Not so much the middle part, though.
Yep, it is true that like there are certain roles that have to be men. That's a funny idea to me as well. I probably still believe that. It's a really difficult thing to discuss. But this has been, aside from everything else, a fascination of mine long before it was as hot button as it is right now. But I feel like there is, I'm really sorry to do this. You're the one who started it. I feel like there's a difference between men and women, and it's something that has fascinated me for a long time. Now, I want to say that my wife and I are the exact opposite of the stereotypes. So we honeymooned in New York City about 13, almost 14 years ago now, and she was the one who had the intuitive, innate sense of direction. She knew how to ride the subway lines almost immediately. She hits the ground and just knows north, south, east, west, where we're going, what line gets where. She is like so in charge, and I am completely oblivious without landmarks, and I'm the one who, when we get into a discussion, I want to talk it out. I want to discuss these things. I have deep emotions, and she's like, how can we fix this? Literally, like you name it. She's the designated driver. When we go anywhere as a family, she's in the driver's seat. I sit in the passenger seat. Part of that came because I drove so much for a job when I was younger. And so I'd be driving, you know, thousands of miles a week. But, you know, we're flip-flopped. However, there are certain things that I think seem to be innately male and certain things that seem to be innately female. And I'm fascinated by that. I don't know that I have an answer for you right now. But it's still something I explore and think deeply on frequently.
Yeah, I've met your wife. I buy that. So here's the other side of it too now. Okay, so obviously this was written before 2016.
Yeah.
The Cubs since then have won the World Series. Were you worried?
Yeah, totally. No, I wasn't, but I did think it was hilarious. And you are correct. It was written before the Cubs won the World Series for the third time. It was written right in that window where they as a baseball team were starting to build some steam. So yeah. I did think like there's a real possibility that this could happen. And I thought it was a fun idea to play with. Because part of the religious upbringing I had that JP and I shared was this constant obsession with the Antichrist and the coming of the end times. There are people who think that Left Behind series is the best thing that was ever written. Yeah. I've got a grandfather who was certain that Barack Obama was the Antichrist and then was certain that, you know, all the way up through, like they're just continue to believe that whoever the political opponent is in the United States, they're the Antichrist. So that's something that I really enjoy because it's metafictionally playing with that idea of like, oh, look, it's really the end times. The Cubs did it.
And the other thing I was curious about is, have you ever actually made mead?
Yes.
The priest had not brewed strong drink since he left the Trappist monastery, seeking a commission to bring relief to God's workers in the Middle East. They waited for final dusk and slipped out of the compound. In a field not far out of town, where a grove of oaks and cedars had been planted, and where the government had allotted millions of gallons of water to be poured, Jesus and the priest found a wild beehive. Jesus prayed over a fallen branch nearby, and the spirit kissed its brittle bark with tongues of flame. Jesus tossed green leaves and milkweed on the fire, and the resulting smoke she used to tame the hive. The priest hiked his habit and scaled the tree after Jesus said, "You have a penis. Being a man comes more naturally to you. Be brave."
So I have brewed several beers in my life, and then I had a friend from up here where I live now, actually, in Oakland, Nebraska, who had done a little bit of making mead. And so I participated with him in getting the batch together and getting everything ready to go and brewing mead. The weird thing is, unfortunately, we got the wrong yeast or something went wrong. And even though we tested it when it came out, it tasted closer to Band-Aids than it did to honey wine. So that was a bummer.
Yeah, that sounds a little dangerous. I kind of figured, since you were kind of detailed about the process of making mead, yeah. that maybe there was some experience of that in your life. Your story is much more literary than the usual fare people hear on my podcast.
Yeah.
My stories are more like, I like to think of them as pop stories. You know how like you've got classical mm-hmm. music and pop music? I like in my stories as like pop stories are like stories that you listen to, you enjoy them. There's a fun little twist at the end or scary twist. Yeah. Depending on the genre. So if you were writing a college essay about this story, what would you say about the symbolism of the roses?
Jesus had never transplanted, let alone transported, grown rose plants. And she knew something was afoot. Something more than the simple movement of flowers for a feast. She asked, if possible, that that cup be taken from her. But, as in prior times, the father was mute in response to the request. Second only to blood, the red damask rose pleased the father most.
Yeah, that's a great question. First, you are correct. It's literary. That was where I went through school. I think I've done a lot of work to try to keep some of the things that I appreciate about literary while moving more toward pop, because I think that, ironically, there is more profound to be found in a pop story than necessarily a literary story. I love both. My favorite authors, many of them are very literary. The symbolism of the roses is probably less deep in terms of the specific flower that was picked and more the fact that you have the Japanese beetles in play. So you needed a flower that the Japanese beetles prey on. And I wanted this idea of the profane defiling something beautiful. So Japanese beetles, I don't know when exactly they really started to come into the United States. We don't see them as much as we did when I wrote the story. So let me think, probably 2015, 2014. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I get them in my front yard on my hydrangeas. Yeah. But yep. I remember taking a vacation when I was a kid, and this was a long time ago, where they were just invading this little resort we were staying at. I mean, there were literally thousands of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wonder if it has something to do with how they flow through the United States. I remember doing a lot of research writing this story about Japanese beetles and just hearing that they had really taken over. And that particular year when I was writing the story, our garden was just, it was covered in them. We had buckets of soapy water out to try to trap them. And it does work really well. There's certain things that they seem to be attracted to. So we would trap hundreds of Japanese beetles in these buckets of soapy water. And you would go out to the rose bushes specifically. The other one that they liked was the beans. So we had stalks of beans and you'd have to go out and knock them into a bucket of soapy water. And it, like, they stink when they die. There's this whole thing. It was very much front of mind while I was writing the story. And I hated them. They look like little greasy oil spots. They're just nasty little bastards. So, or hope I can say that, jerks.
Yeah, no problem. So it's I always find it when I'm writing that I put a lot of my own personal experience into my stories, yeah. and you can sense that too when you read another author who has like very specific details about things. It's like they live this. They didn't just research this. They live this.
Right. Absolutely. Yep. A lot of the story is that way for me.
Well, I hope people will take a listen to the story. But before we go, I want you to tell us a little bit more about your other books.
Yeah. So the Lucan Time Mysteries will be a 9-book series. I'm currently hard at work about halfway through the fifth in the 9 books. The fourth is out, an advanced reader's copy. I'm doing something I haven't heard of other people doing before. It's called The Six Sorrows of Shohei Matsui. It's only available in paperback right now. And if you buy a copy off of Amazon or my website, it'll come to you as an advanced reader's copy. And I'm going to continue to do that while I'm working through the final edit. So it does have some typos in it. It's probably going to have a small amount of content changed. But I thought, I don't sell enough books that it's a really big deal right now to have maybe 100, 200 copies out there that are advanced readers' copies. They'll maybe be worth something more, a little bit of a collector's item. They'll all come to you signed. And the story follows Luke and Lyle. They're private detectives who both have their own addiction issues, and they are grappling with the big, bad, evil chaos named Marva DeLonghi and her husband Ransom DeLonghi. And it's deeply influenced by my favorite living author, Stephen King. I love his work, and he has infused my way of thinking and being. And so I wanted to play with that a little bit, as well as J.K. Rowling, especially what she's doing with the Cormorant Strike novels. And so if either of those pique your interest, you probably enjoy what I'm doing with the Lugentine Mysteries.
Certainly. I mean, I, for people who are watching on video, I've got a couple of Jodi's books on my shelf here. I've always been jealous of the cover art. He's got this really graphic thing that when you look at it, you go, what is that? And it just draws you in. It's one of my favorite, my whole series of my favorite book covers. Each one's a different color that sort of pops out with the white and black in the color. And I understand you have an artist that you use for these that comes very cheap.
Yeah, exactly. Cheap or expensive, depending on how you think about it. I don't pay any money for it, but I certainly pay in labor. My wife is a trained graphic artist, and so she's phenomenal at putting them together. And I'm so thankful for the work that she's done.
Now, and the way that we met actually was way back when I was a guest on your podcast when it was called Create Collaborate.
Yep.
And then it evolved into the Reluctant Bookmarker, which was, to be honest, my favorite book name. But and then TRBM, which was kind of like you know, a pop version of it, I think. Yeah. And now its newest iteration is becoming a household name. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I'll skip over the reasons for the changes just by saying, I probably hurt my own self by changing the title of the podcast as much as I do, but I am completely beholden to my own emotion and my sense of being true to myself, which is I am tireless at trying to figure out how to market books. I'm not very good at it. And so when I did change the name most recently to becoming a household name, I realized I can't speak to you as an expert book marketer. I don't want to claim that I can. But I can tell you a lot about my journey trying to become a household name and doing so as an author. I want people to eventually talk about my work the same way that they do with Stephen King. And so I can document that experience and be honest about it. And more often than not, my efforts are failures, but I just keep moving forward and I won't quit. And I think that's the heart of it because my goal is to have my name be in every household in America.
Well, you may not be the best marketer, but you are the best salesman I've seen. You and I have done a couple of Comic-Cons together, selling books at a table, at a comic book convention, lots of artisans and memorabilia and game salespeople, and where's they're selling books. I understand you do that quite often. You and I are going to be when this podcast drops, we are going to be at the Chicago Printers Row Literary Festival, downtown Chicago. So if you would like to meet Jodi, if you'd like to buy his books, I'm sure there will be special deals there at the table. And of course, you get them signed. The other thing I want to mention, too, is the audiobooks. You have got probably some of my favorite audiobooks I've ever listened to, the audio versions of your books.
Thank you. Yeah. I was listening to Chuck Wendig, his book, Wanderers, and he has several narrators in there. One of them is Exie Sands. And I immediately, when I heard her voice, I was like, she has to be the voice of Luke.
I leaned against the brick facade outside her office, drawing figures of infinity in the air with my favorite 4-inch pocket knife. My thoughts were as stained as my shoes from wandering every dark alley in Omaha. Two voices spoke muffled words on the other side of the door. Maybe love, maybe fear. I flicked my knife closed, dropped it in my purse, and turned the knob to see which.
And so I reached out to her through Twitter. I have a large enough following on Twitter that I tend to get people who will respond to me. And I just insulted her indirectly. I said, I have this main character who's an addicted, loudmouth, horrible person, and I think you would be perfect to narrate these books. Then I hit send and realized I just indirectly insulted her. But she got back to me and said it sounded like something she would really like. She said, I'm really expensive, so that may be an issue, but if you can afford, I'd love to work with you. And we made it work. So yeah, she narrates these books. The fifth book in the series I'm doing right now is from the perspective of the male character, and so I'm going to have to find somebody else to narrate. I've got somebody in mind who's also expensive, so we'll kind of see what I'm able to swing, but I really, really want to keep her for all of the books that are narrated from the first person perspective.
Well, that'd be an interesting change of pace. I didn't see that.
Yeah. Yet. Yeah. I had it in my mind that it was going to happen. And all the way up until I started writing book five, I wasn't sure I was going to do it. And then I had literally the first line of the book come to me, and I knew. I was like, okay, I get this. And so it's been a lot of fun.
Let's see, anything else we have talked about? I think that covers it all. Thank you for joining me here today.
Yeah. Thank you.
I hope people will tune in and listen to your story on Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs. That's over at bedtimestories.studio, or look for it on your favorite podcast app, or Audible, Spotify, all over the place. Recently was nominated again for the Podcast Awards for Best Fiction Podcast, so fingers crossed that we cross the finish line on that one again. And Jody, it's been a pleasure. I will see you soon, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I look forward to it. The Luke in Time Mysteries begins with two private detectives. Luke, who's got a little bit of a drinking problem, and her partner Lyle, who's got a little bit of an eating problem. Together, they've got pretty big money problem. So when Marva walks into their office, offering gobs of cash, if they can find someone who's trying to kill her, they take the job without asking any question, which becomes their biggest problem, because soon enough, they walk into a trap and wind up dead. But that's not where this story ends. In fact, it's just the setup, because they go back to the moment where they first met Marva. And until Luke and Lyle can solve Marva's mystery, they keep dying over and over again. If this book sounds like something you'd enjoy, check the links in the show notes to learn more.
You can find out more about the nine lives of Marva DeLonghi and the Luke and Time Mysteries at jodyjsperling.com.